Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, March 21st, 2024. The text of the $1.2 trillion spending package, the final six fiscal year 2024 bills to fund the government, has been released, but it's uncertain whether the bill will pass both the House and Senate and be signed into law by Friday night's deadline that prevents a partial government shutdown. Attorney General Merrick Garland announces an antitrust lawsuit against Apple, alleging that the company uses monopolistic power to engage in unfair business practices when it comes to its iPhones and watches. We'll talk about it with Axios tech policy reporter Ashley Gold. U.S. House Administration Committee holds a hearing on how members of Congress and their staff are affected by crime in Washington, D.C. Secretary of State Antony Blinken meets with Egypt's president in Cairo before heading to Israel on Friday, talking about trying to reach a deal for a ceasefire with Hamas in return for Hamas releasing hostages and getting more humanitarian aid into Gaza. And the World War II U.S. Ghost Army receives the Congressional Gold Medal. These once top secret units used deception, like inflatable fake tanks and false radio transmissions, to fool the German military into thinking the American forces were much stronger than they were. Story from NBC News. Lawmakers early Thursday morning released the text of a $1.2 trillion government funding bill negotiated by the White House and leaders of both parties to avoid a partial government shutdown this weekend. The spending deal announced Tuesday includes funding for the Departments of Homeland Security, Defense, State, Labor, Health and Human Services, and other parts of the government. It would take a Herculean effort for both chambers to pass the 1,012-page bill before the end of the day on Friday, particularly in the Senate, where all 100 senators would have to agree to speed up consideration to do so. That was from NBC News. House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, was interviewed this morning on CNBC about what's in the bill, whether he'll waive the 72-hour waiting period in the House rules between the time the bill text is posted and the floor vote, and about bringing the bill up for a vote under procedures that require a two-thirds vote to pass. And that means the slim Republican majority will need to rely on Democratic votes.
Because of divided government, it's not a perfect piece of legislation. It's not the one we would draft and pass if the Republicans had control of the House, the Senate, and the White House. And I think you'll see that next year. But right now, we're managing it, getting it through, and I think we'll avoid a long shutdown for the government.
Yeah, and certain members of your caucus wouldn't even grant you that there's anything in here, any wins. They call crumb. I don't know what they call it, but there are some things in here that you got done. And there were things that former Speaker McCarthy accomplished that I don't think he got credit for. He was going to keep the government open and do what he thought was right no matter what, and we know what happened to him, but I don't think that the will's not there to do that again. And I think you can do what you think is right, and you know, that's what, just like he had to do it, it's something maybe you're going to have to do. You can tell me, though. I'm not going to put words in your mouth.
Well, look, I say it all the time, democracy's messy. It's particularly messy right now in a moment like this, but we have to get the job done. And there are some very substantial wins in here. 70% of this spending package is the Department of Defense. It's defense spending. And we all know what a critical time it is in that category right now. The world is on fire. We have unrest and hot wars around the globe, and our military, our troops are out serving valiantly, and they deserve to be paid for it. So in this package, we have the highest military pay raise in almost 40 years. We've also, at the same time, however, cut unnecessary and I think ridiculous spending. The DEI programs, for example, take a $50 million haircut here. So we can take care of our priorities and do the right thing. Another big piece of this is border security. You know, Republicans on our side, we want enforcement of the law. That's what the administration is not doing. So in this package, we're able to increase enforcement capacity. We're increasing the number of detention beds for ICE so that we can hold those who come in illegally. And we are supplying more Border Patrol agents, 22,000 of those. That was in our package, H.R. 2, our border security measure. So some of our objectives are being met. Some of them are being done. At the same time, in this package, we're also cutting, rescinding spending for the IRS expansion fund, about 20 billion of that. And then you got rescission of some of the other unnecessary duplicative spending. So we got some of the things we wanted. We didn't get everything we wanted, but we'll continue to move forward. And I think next year, a totally different process because we'll have the majorities in both chambers. I'm convinced of that.
So are you going to waive the 72? Are you going to go that route? I'll tell you what I'm asking. If this is just what I'm hearing, that if you did give a delay, didn't do it, and let Negotiations go on. I think, 43 of your caucus members wrote you a letter that they want this, they want that. You know, it's just horrible. You're not getting anything. That's not why we were sent here. Out of that 43, I think one of them has voted ever yes on any budget whatsoever. So if you give them the weekend and you close the government and, you know, help the Republicans snatch defeat from the jaws of victory one more time when the big election comes up, what do you get for it? So will you do the 72-hour waiver? Can you announce that now, Mr. Speaker?
Well, look, we have to get this job done. The 72-hour time period is something, it's a principle that we all defend, I always have. We want members to be able to understand legislation, have a time to review it before they vote on it, want a concept. So everybody is reading this quickly, they're doing that, and we'll see. I'm going to talk to colleagues this morning. I think we have to get this done by the weekend because I think the stakes are too high.
But that will mean to get two-thirds, if you do waive it, there'll be a lot of Democrats, and you're willing to do that.
Well, it's what we have to do in divided government. We can't get a rule done on this for our own party, so that means you can't have a bare majority. Remember, we only have a two-vote margin. You have to get two-thirds. And so, yeah, by necessity, you have to get both parties to agree to a lot of this, and I think that's what will happen.
House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, interviewed this morning on CNBC. Republican Congressman Ken Buck of Colorado is resigning from the House on Friday, at which time there will be 218 Republicans, 213 Democrats, and 4 vacancies. Congressman Ralph Norman, Republican from South Carolina, a member of the Freedom Caucus, was interviewed on C-SPAN this morning to talk about his opposition to this six-bill spending package and to waiving the 72-hour rule between the time the text is posted and the time the vote takes place.
What we have that we received a little after 2 this morning was a 1,000-page document. We'll have 24 hours to decipher it and then schedule to vote on it at either 10 or 11 tomorrow. For your listeners, under what scenario would anyone sign off on a 1,000-page document to, let's say, a purchase of a car or a house, much less one as this deal does? This puts us $1.8 trillion more in debt. On what scenario would you sign off on? It's total insanity. It shouldn't be brought to the floor. We ought to do a continuing resolution through at least May. And it's not a good day for America.
Is it a good day for Speaker Mike Johnson if he has to rely on Democratic votes to get this through the House?
Well, that's what he's going to do. We met with Mike earlier this week, and we have a 72-hour rule that is a rule. It can be waived, but to go over something this important. And Greta, the overriding issue is this immigration crisis that we have in this country. Nothing ought to be signed off on until we close the border. And it's just not happening. We relayed our concerns to him in the Freedom Caucus. And obviously it's going to be ignored. And is it a good day for Mike Johnson? In my opinion, no, particularly not for conservatives.
Is his job in jeopardy?
You have to ask him that. He knows the downside of what he's doing. I like Mike. I voted for him. I supported the ouster of Speaker McCarthy. But I'm very, very disappointed in this action. This is for the survival of this country. And financially, we're going over the cliff. So it's a minibus going over the cliff. I would hope that it would be it would be voted down. It's got to get 289 votes, three-fourths of the on suspension that you have to get. I hope it's voted down, but we'll have a block of us that will vote a solid no.
Is there anyone in that block of those Freedom Caucus members who are discussing bringing a motion to vacate to the floor?
I have not heard that, Greta. I mean, obviously that's always on the table, but I haven't heard that.
Why not support this legislation and do away with another continuing resolution as you were advocating for when there is apparently bipartisan agreement?
Well, no deal is better than a bad deal. Look at the earmarks. The last, the 6 prior appropriation bills had right at $12 billion in earmarks for special projects. This one is no different. I think this one is worse. So, and let's say if you take that stance, I think we want to support it, at least have 72 hours to go over it. And that's just not happening. You have to read and decipher anything before you sign it, whether it's a small business deal or a big business deal. This one is for the survival of the country. And how much more can this country take? $37 trillion in debt when you put the Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare on the table, we're more like the $60 trillion, which is unsustainable. The interest alone will surpass the $850 billion that we have for our military. It's unacceptable.
Congressman Ralph Norman, Republican from South Carolina, on C-SPAN's morning program, The Washington Journal. The House Democratic leader, Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries of New York, held a news conference today, asked how many Democrats would vote for this $1.2 trillion spending package. He said a substantial majority. He also said that a government shutdown is not acceptable.
And under no circumstances can we tolerate a government shutdown, which will hurt the American people. We have a responsibility to make sure that the government is funded, and the six appropriations bills do so in a way that takes care of the health, the safety, the education, and the economic well-being of the American people. And I look forward to the bills being brought to the floor for passage tomorrow.
Congressman Hakeem Jeffries, the minority leader, Democrat from New York. An article at Roll Call reads, the agreement marks the culmination of a tumultuous budget cycle that began with the election of former Speaker Kevin McCarthy, Republican of California, with pledges to rein in spending, which proved too heavy a lift. McCarthy's conference tried for months with middling success to produce the votes for bills that would cut spending below the previous fiscal year and impose conservative social policy riders. But they mostly hit a wall with GOP centrists, who knew the right-leaning bills would never advance in the Democrat-controlled Senate anyway. McCarthy wound up sacked by rebellious members of his conference, ostensibly for putting a stopgap funding bill on the floor last September without any conservative wins. But McCarthy's successor, Speaker Mike Johnson, ultimately chose a similar path. Adhering to the spending and debt limit deal McCarthy cut with Biden, President Biden, with only modest change. That from Roll Call. When it passes the House, and this package is expected to pass the House, it'll head over to the Senate. The majority leader there, Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, saying on the floor he plans to move on that bill as quickly as possible. Friday night is the deadline to avoid the shutdown.
Earlier this morning, the legislative text for the final six appropriations bills was released, I'm happy to say, clearing another hurdle towards our ultimate goal of funding the federal government. I thank the appropriators, their staffs, and everyone involved for working themselves to the bone to release these bills. I imagine some folks here in the Capitol are past the point of exhaustion. This funding agreement between the White House and congressional leaders is good news that comes in the nick of time. When passed, it will extinguish any more shutdown threats for the rest of the fiscal year. It will avoid the scythe of budget sequestration, and it will keep the government open without cuts or poison pill riders. It's now the job of the House Republican leadership to move this package ASAP. Just like the funding bills Congress passed 2 weeks ago, this package avoids draconian Republican cuts on major Democratic wins that help American families, American workers, America's national defense. We have secured an increase in child care services. We boosted disease research and prevention. We funded school mental health programs and suicide prevention, so needed in this modern world in which we live. We are strengthening the border with new resources for frontline personnel. We are investing in safer, more secure elections, and we Democrats are very proud of both. The hard right pushed for cuts that would have impacted K-12 education, services for low-income families. Democrats stopped it. The hard right wanted to add terrible poison pill riders to attack freedom of choice. Democrats stopped that, too. Now, Congress must now race to pass this package before government funding runs out this Friday. Once the House acts, the Senate will need bipartisan cooperation to pass it before Friday's deadline and avoid a shutdown.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, on the Senate floor. Also speaking about this spending package, Senator Mike Lee, Republican from Utah.
Yesterday, at about this same time, I came to the floor and I made three predictions. Even though not a single member of this body had seen the full text of the 1,000-page spending bill that we received just after 2:30 a.m. this morning, I predicted three things about that bill. I predicted that it would, number one, be full of corrupting earmarks. Well, the bill has nearly 1,400 earmarks, 138 pages of the more than 1,000 pages in this bill are dedicated to earmarks alone. Two, that it wouldn't force Biden to secure the border. Well, it doesn't. And three, that it would perpetuate massive deficits. It does. Mr. President, I really hate to say I told you so. It's now Thursday, a little more than 48 hours before the funding deadline, and we received the 1,012-page bill at 2:30 in the morning. We're told that the only way we can avoid a shutdown is to vote for a 1,000-page bill, negotiated in secret and put forward at the last minute by the law firm of Schumer, McConnell, Johnson, and Jeffries. With a little more than 48 hours on the clock, we can be sure that there will be no time to read the text, to vet it with our staffs and our constituents, to debate the bill and offer amendments to improve the bill. This is not, regardless of what state we come from or what party we're part of, this is not what our constituents, our voters, sent us to Washington to do.
Senator Mike Lee, Republican from Utah, on the Senate floor. And again, the House will be debating and voting on this $1.2 trillion six appropriation bill package for fiscal year 2024 on Friday. The House is in at 9 a.m. Eastern. We'll have live coverage as always, gavel to gavel on C-SPAN television. We'll also have it here on C-SPAN radio. If it passes the House, it's over to the Senate. And tomorrow night, Friday night, midnight, is the deadline to avoid the government shutdown. While fiscal year 2024 spending is being completed, Congress is also examining President Joe Biden's fiscal year 2025 budget request. The new fiscal year starts October 1st. The White House Budget Director Shalanda Young testified today before the House Budget Committee. She was asked about deficit spending by Congressman Bob Good, Republican from Virginia, chair of the Freedom Caucus.
$52 trillion is what his proposed budget, I didn't make it up, it's his budget, it's in writing, that it would go from $34 trillion to $52 trillion in 10 years. Now, what does that amount equate to per citizen? If we take the 300, at that, it's estimated, but the Census Bureau says we'll have 350 million Americans in 10 years, 350 million. So if you take the $52 trillion, divide by 350 million Americans, about how much per citizen is that?
Mr. Good, that is a false
It's a math question.
It is a false narrative.
No, the question is, if we take the, reclaiming my time, thank you, I didn't ask
his time.
Reclaiming my time, if we take $52 trillion, we divide it by 350 million Americans, that comes out to how much? How much do we each owe? What is our share?
I'm not playing into this narrative as if we
Okay, let me answer the question for you. It's $150,000 per citizen, is what the president is projecting without any emergency supplemental extra spending to take our national debt. That's what he's projecting to do, which equates to about $400,000 per household by his projection. Now, we have never had this level of debt in history. We have never had this level of debt to GDP since World War II, and I'm sure you're aware of that. How would the president propose we would respond to a major crisis, say World War III, or some other, the next virus situation or whatever, with this level of debt coming into it?
Mr.
How would
Good,
we respond
to
that?
Are we not in a crisis situation now with what's going on in Ukraine?
We are.
What's going on in the Middle East?
Isn't it
this
interesting? Isn't it interesting?
A plan and to respond
reclaiming
to
my time,
both of
thank
those,
you. Reclaiming my time, thank
and,
you.
And the border.
Reclaiming my time,
this
Mr. Chairman,
acting.
I'm reclaiming my time.
The gentleman reclaims his time.
I don't
time.
Have a question there now. It's interesting on the priorities of this administration that the first thing you proclaim as the crisis is what's going on in Ukraine. I would submit that the president has created a debt crisis unprecedented in our history, and he proposes to make it worse over the next 10 years because he wants to increase the debt by $18 trillion by his own budget. He has created a border crisis, which is further exacerbated by this budget, by the way, which does nothing to address the border crisis that he has created. But yet, when you speak of crisis, you bring up Ukraine because the president wants to borrow, or print, some $60 billion and send it overseas to Ukraine. I think it's great that you are illustrating for the American people what this president's priorities are, both illustrated by his budget today and your inability to answer basic questions about the budget today and the impact upon the American people by the debt that he is willfully creating, and you go right to Ukraine.
The gentleman has 30 more seconds.
With the border supplemental, Mr. Good.
The gentleman's going to get 30 more seconds, and I'm going to give the gentlelady, Director Young, time to respond, but you get 30 more seconds.
Well, so does the president have an understanding what the impact is of his spending, his deficits, his growing debt on Bidenflation, under which the American people are suffering? Does he understand the impact, again, of his spending, his borrowing, his printing, his debt that's causing the Bidenflation under which American people are suffering? Does he understand that?
And with that, the gentleman's time has expired, but you will have as much time as you want to answer.
Mr. Chairman, I get why people don't want to give the president credit for 15 million jobs added, for unemployment being at a 50-year historic low, under 4% for 2 years. I get that. I get the grandstanding. But if you want to do something about the border, which I've heard a lot about, there was a bill right in front of Congress to provide resources and authorities, more than anybody could ever dreamed of in any bipartisan scenario. But we choose to come in rooms like this to talk about the budget and blast the president who tried to do something about it.
You are the budget director. You ought to be able to answer budget questions.
It's Congressman Bob Good, Republican from Virginia, chair of the Freedom Caucus at today's House Budget Committee hearing, asking the questions of the witness, Shalonda Young, director of the White House Office of Management and Budget, a hearing on the president's fiscal year 2025 budget proposal. Story from HuffPost, the symbolic Republican budget proposal introduced this week includes cuts to future Social Security retirement benefits, despite former President Donald Trump's pledge to leave the program untouched. The Republican Study Committee, a group encompassing a majority of GOP House members, put out a budget outline on Wednesday calling for spending reductions in Social Security and Medicare. The proposal calls for modest changes to Social Security benefits for individuals who are not near retirement, according to a one-paragraph summary in the study committee's outline, and it would also make modest adjustments to the retirement age for future retirees to account for increases in life expectancy, the summary said, offering no further specifics. That from HuffPost. The U.S. House today continued work on a series of energy-related bills that the Republican majority scheduled for floor debate, each one critical of a Biden administration policy or possible policy. One today was on a resolution opposing a carbon tax, a tax on coal, oil, and natural gas designed to increase the cost of those fuels and encourage the use of cleaner energy sources. Congressman Jason Smith, Republican from Missouri, supported the resolution.
The Biden administration is already giving billion-dollar corporations and big banks massive, massive tax breaks under the so-called Inflation Reduction Act. This is the same administration that is celebrating spending over $1 trillion and counting on special interest green energy handouts, including electric vehicle tax credits for wealthy, wealthy households, while funneling American tax dollars to countries like China. But for working families, a carbon tax would not only raise prices at the pump, but also at the grocery store. It would raise the cost of doing business on Main Street at a time when America's small businesses are struggling under the highest interest rates in over two decades. Those who can least afford to pay more, like seniors on fixed incomes, would suffer the most.
Congressman Jason Smith, Republican from Missouri and chair of the Ways and Means Committee, on the House floor today. Congressman Earl Blumenauer, Democrat from Oregon, a member of that committee, opposed this resolution.
This winter was the warmest winter on record in the United States, 5.4 degrees higher. 2023 was the world's warmest year on record. In fact, the 10 warmest years have occurred in the last 10 years. And what's the response from our Republican friends? They make stuff up. They move away from solutions that would make a difference. Every independent analyst, Republican and Democrat alike, agrees that the way that we're going to deal with carbon pollution, notwithstanding some of the climate deniers on the other side of the aisle, is a carbon tax. The rest of the world is moving in this direction. Having a price on carbon is the most efficient, cost-effective, and fair way to deal with this crisis. But they're having none of it. As I say, they're making stuff up in the face of things that have real consequences. There are people dying in the Pacific Northwest from the unprecedented heat wave. We've had unprecedented events in California, extreme weather events. And the costs of those extreme weather events dwarf the costs that they are dreaming up in fantasy.
Congressman Earl Blumenauer, Democrat from Oregon, on the House floor. This resolution opposing a carbon tax passed the House 222-196. There was one no Republican vote. Brian Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania and 10 Democrats voted yes. The House also passed a second bill today to, quote, denounce the harmful anti-American energy policies and condemn the energy crisis that has been caused by the Biden administration. That was a vote of 217-200, four Democrats voting yes with all Republicans. This is all part of a series of energy-related bills on the House floor this week. Over in the Senate, they confirmed former Florida State Democratic lawmaker Jose Javier Rodriguez to be Assistant Labor Secretary for Employment and Training. Vote was 50-48. There was one Democratic no vote, Joe Manchin of West Virginia. And also the Senate voted to disapprove a Biden administration rule allowing imports of fresh beef from Paraguay into the United States. 70-25, that's veto-proof. President Biden strongly opposes it. This bill now heads to the House. Wall Street today, the Dow up 269, Nasdaq up 32, S&P up 16. From the New York Times, the Justice Department joined 16 states and the District of Columbia to file an antitrust lawsuit against Apple on Thursday, the federal government's most significant challenge to the reach and influence of the company that has put iPhones in the hands of more than a billion people. In an 88-page lawsuit, the government argued that Apple had violated antitrust laws with practices that were intended to keep customers reliant on their iPhones and less likely to switch to a competing device. Reporting from the New York Times, Attorney General Merrick Garland made the announcement at the Justice Department in Washington.
We allege that Apple has employed a strategy that relies on exclusionary, anti-competitive conduct that hurts both consumers and developers. For consumers, that has meant fewer choices, higher prices and fees, lower quality smartphones, apps, and accessories, and less innovation from Apple and its competitors. For developers, that has meant being forced to play by rules that insulate Apple from competition. And as outlined in our complaint, we allege that Apple has consolidated its monopoly power, not by making its own products better, but by making other products worse. Apple carries out its exclusionary anti-competitive conduct in two principal ways. First, Apple imposes contractual restrictions and fees that limit the features and functionality that developers can offer iPhone users. Second, Apple selectively restricts access to the points of connection between third-party apps and the iPhone's operating system, degrading the functionality of non-Apple apps and accessories. As a result, for most of the past 15 years, Apple has collected a tax in the form of a 30% commission on the price of any app downloaded from the App Store, as well as on in-app purchases. Apple is able to command these fees from companies of all sizes. Apple has also suppressed the emergence of programs like cloud streaming apps, including gaming apps, as well as super apps that could reduce user dependence on Apple's own operating system and expensive hardware. And as any iPhone user who has ever seen a green text message or received a tiny, grainy video can attest, Apple's anti-competitive conduct also includes making it more difficult for iPhone users to message with users of non-Apple products. It does this by diminishing the functionality of its own messaging app and by diminishing the functionality of third-party messaging apps. By doing so, Apple knowingly and deliberately degrades quality, privacy, and security for its users.
Attorney General Merrick Garland, and with more on the Justice Department's antitrust lawsuit against Apple. Joining us on the phone is Ashley Gold, tech and policy reporter for Axios. Thanks for being with us today. This looks big, historically big.
Yeah, it's pretty big. It's a sweeping lawsuit, and it covers quite a lot of ground, even more than I was expecting. And Apple, you know, has a lot of reason to be worried right now.
Has Apple responded to the Justice Department?
They have. They've said the lawsuit is without merit. It is a solution in search of a problem, and that they are popular and beloved by consumers because they're the best and they provide the most seamless experience, and that they plan on fighting this lawsuit vigorously in court.
Has the Justice Department provided evidence in its lawsuit filing to back up the claims?
So their evidence that if you think the evidence backs up the claims, it depends how you think about antitrust and, you know, what you should count as illegal competition. It may be hard for the outside observer that just has an iPhone and is a regular consumer to see why these practices that they are alleging in the lawsuit may be anti-competitive. But a lot of developers that rely on the iPhone to distribute their apps and people who don't have iPhones, who have Android devices or other devices altogether, find that Apple's policies, you know, either exclude them, make it costly for them to switch services, or other complaints. But whether those complaints are enough to be counted as illegal monopoly maintenance, that's going to be up to the judge.
Is the Justice Department specifying what remedies it's looking for, or is that going to be a later part of the trial?
So they outline a couple remedies. It basically has to do with stopping Apple from enforcing a lot of its terms and services that have to do with how the App Store runs, have to do with how its digital wallet runs, how it allows streaming apps on the iPhone or doesn't. So it wants them to change a bunch of business practices that Apple claim are necessary to keep the user experience sort of secure and seamless, but the DOJ argues hurts rivals and hurts consumers. So they essentially want Apple to change up their whole ecosystem. And Apple has argued against that already, saying that's not what a judge is supposed to do.
We're talking with Ashley Gold from Axios. One of the questions at the Justice Department news conference was whether consumers could see lower prices if this is a successful lawsuit. Is that going to be a point of contention? Will Apple say no? It's the fact that the prices may go up.
Yeah, I think that what they are arguing is what the DOJ is arguing is if there was more smartphone competition, prices of smartphones would sort of be lowered overall and that people would end up paying less. But I think that people would argue that smartphones are more expensive because materials are more expensive, inflation, the phones do more now, it's more advanced technology, it's more sophisticated chips. So I think that they would argue that the prices haven't gone up arbitrarily. It's based on the market and the realities we're looking at. So I definitely see Apple arguing against the idea that they could drop prices pretty strongly.
What's the next step in the lawsuit? And I'm almost afraid to ask this. How long do these suits take to resolve?
Oh, they take years. It could be at least 2 to 3 years before we see this go to trial. Apple will first move to dismiss the lawsuit. They already said they're going to do that. So, you know, the DOJ will have to respond to that. A judge will make a preliminary decision there. I don't see it getting dismissed. I see it going to trial. This is it could follow the same playbook as the Google antitrust lawsuit that's going on right now that ended up going to trial, even though Google tried to have it dismissed. But yeah, it's a long haul. It could be 2 to 3 years before we see this in a courtroom.
And a final question. You mentioned the Google lawsuit. It was also brought up at the news conference that the Biden administration is suing Amazon. What's the approach of the Biden administration when it comes to antitrust and these big companies?
I think that the big tech companies have gotten away with sort of doing whatever they want and growing extremely big and extremely powerful and sort of shutting out rival smaller companies for too long. And the big test now is to see whether the public cares about that or if it's just a problem for these other companies that are trying to compete with them. The Biden administration and the antitrust officials are trying to prove this idea that just because something doesn't cost more all the time doesn't mean it's not hurting consumers. It's a newer way of sort of interpreting our old antitrust laws. So we've yet to see whether that really works, and we're going to have to wait until these trials wrap up.
Ashley Gold, tech and policy reporter for Axios. Find her stories at axios.com and on X at Ashley Gold. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Washington Today continues in a moment.
Hi, it's Kayla from C-SPAN. Imagine 45 years ago when there was just a handful of television networks. C-SPAN first went on the air bringing an unfiltered view of government directly to America's living rooms. No spin, no commentary, just pure democracy in action.
And it's Greta from C-SPAN. It was a bold experiment. We finally had a front row seat to Congress, the White House, and the campaign trail, all without government funding.
As we celebrate 45 years and a legacy of unfiltered access, we ask for your support of a donation in honor of our four decades of service. Your gift, no matter how big or small, will help maintain this vital resource for access to the democratic process.
You can help ensure another 45 years of witnessing history unfold and empowering citizens to be informed and engaged in the political process. Visit cspan.org/donate today and join our 45th anniversary campaign.
Thank you for supporting C-SPAN, your unfiltered view of government. Visit cspan.org/donate today to make your gift of support. Thank you.
Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you find your podcasts and also on the C-SPAN Now mobile app, and that's free. ABC News reporting before today's House Administration Committee hearing, the Washington, D.C. Police Union is set to declare a crisis during its testimony at a hearing before lawmakers on Capitol Hill Thursday. The hearing, which will focus on the impact of crime in Washington on congressional operations and visitors, comes a little over a week after the city passed a bill aimed at curbing crime in the nation's capital. Although violent crime is down 17% compared to the same time last year, crime was up significantly in 2023, especially in Ward 6, which includes Capitol Hill. That was the story from ABC News. Here's part of the opening statement of the chair of the Washington, D.C. Police Union, Greg Pemberton.
D.C. residents and businesses, and business owners are under siege. Members of Congress are being assaulted and carjacked. Your congressional staff members are being robbed and stabbed. Tourists and visitors, your constituents, are being targeted and attacked. Yet the D.C. Council fails to admit that their policies have played a significant role in this outcome. Now, almost 4 years later, we have all seen the results of D.C. Council's experiment. The empirical data is in, and we know for a fact that their efforts have been an abject failure, resulting in thousands of more victims of crime for the city.
Craig Pemberton, chair of the D.C. Police Union. Later in this hearing, the House Administration Committee chair, Congressman Brian Stile, Republican from Wisconsin, asked him more about this issue.
Countless congressional staffers have been robbed within a mile of the Capitol. Last year, a staffer for Senator Rand Paul, he was stabbed repeatedly, puncturing his lungs and skull. A member of Congress was assaulted in an elevator, and a representative was carjacked just down the road. All these crimes happened within a mile of here, largely in Ward 6, represented by Councilmember Charles Allen. We invited Allen to speak today, but he rejected that invitation. Mr. Pemberton, you mentioned some of the bills the D.C. Council passed in the last 2 years that have had a negative impact on policing. I want to focus in on the Youth Rehabilitation Act that passed in 2018 that reduced sentences for first-time offenders. Is it true that the bill raised the age of what is considered a youth to 24 years of age?
That's correct.
So if a 24-year-old was to commit a carjacking with a gun in our nation's capital, they would be eligible for a reduced sentence under that law?
That's correct.
If you encountered people who've used this program more than once, contrary to how the program was sold?
Absolutely.
So you know individuals who are well over the age of 18, up to the age of 24, who could commit a carjacking with a gun, be eligible for a reduced sentence, and that can happen multiple times?
Yes, absolutely.
And what would be the impact of an individual who does this? What's your analysis of that law?
there's no consequence for the actions of their behavior, and they understand that. So when they get back out on the street, they're free to recommit these crimes as often as they like.
What does that do to the morale of police officers serving in the Metropolitan Police Department?
It's horrible because you're arresting people for violent crimes, and then they're back out on the street the next day, and then they're never held accountable for their actions. And it really takes an impact on morale.
So an officer would risk their life to try to apprehend a dangerous criminal, in this case, maybe a 24-year-old who carjacked someone with a gun, only to find out that this individual is treated as a youth in our nation's capital with limited consequences and can find themselves back out on the street in short order to commit another crime?
This is what happens more often than not. Yeah, this is regular.
So then if we look at the numbers in D.C., violent crime increased last year by 39%, homicides increased 35%, robberies increased 67%, and carjackings increased 82%. And so for those reasons, we created a House Security Resources Guide after a briefing with you last September. Would you agree that the D.C.'s increase in crime is a direct result of the policies pushed by the D.C. City Council and anti-policing and soft-on-crime policies?
Absolutely.
Witness Greg Pemberton, chair of the D.C. Police Union, questioned by Congressman Brian Stile, Republican from Wisconsin, chair of the House Administration Committee at today's hearing. Another witness was the U.S. Capitol Police Chief Thomas Manger, and the committee ranking Democrat Joseph Morelli of New York asked him about access to guns.
I want to ask you, Chief Manger, particularly since you have responsibility for the Capitol complex and this hearing is really about Capitol Hill. In fact, it's titled Safety on Capitol Hill, and you have responsibility for that. You mentioned in your testimony that the Capitol Police confiscated an M4-style ghost gun near the Senate Parks, stopped an assault rifle from getting to Capitol Hill, and arrested an individual with a high-capacity magazine. I also know you have experience as a police chief in both Maryland and Virginia. How are these guns making their way into Washington, D.C.?
Typically, they're coming from other states. And I can tell you, having been a police officer in Virginia for 27 years, Virginia's got plenty of guns.
And many of those guns are making their way into Washington, D.C.?
They make their way to a lot of places.
And your professional opinion, would the Capitol campus and the area immediately around it be safer without M4-style ghost guns, assault rifles, and high-capacity magazines on the street?
Certainly in the wrong hands, yes.
Yeah. Do you believe your officers would be safer if it was more difficult to obtain M4-style guns, assault rifles, and high-capacity magazines?
So any police officer is safe when there's fewer guns around, in my view.
U.S. Capitol Police Chief Thomas Manger testifying before the House Administration Committee. The questions coming from the ranking Democrat on the committee, Joseph Morelli of New York. The chief also announced today a new initiative to create a command center for the department's Protective Services Bureau that will take intake reports of threats against members, monitor residential security for lawmakers and leadership, and analyze intelligence. Now to the war between Israel and Hamas. The story from NBC News, the U.S. has submitted a draft resolution to the United Nations calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza that is tied to the release of Israeli hostages, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Wednesday. Blinken, on his sixth tour of the Middle East since October, said in an interview on Saudi TV that a truce deal was getting closer, although he did not elaborate. He will travel, writes NBC News, to Israel tomorrow after meetings in Egypt today. The language of the resolution is the strongest yet put forward by the Biden administration. While in Egypt, the secretary held a news conference with the Egyptian foreign minister.
Mr. Secretary, you mentioned Doha while talking about ceasefire talks. Can you confirm CIA Chief Bill Burns is going to be there? And do you think these talks are now in final stretch? You also talked about your meeting with Saudi Crown Prince. What progress exactly have you made? Are we close to having a U.S. Saudi civil defense pact and cooperation on civil nuclear agreement. What are the remaining sticking points? And on Rafah, Israel's strategic minister Ron Dermer in a podcast said Israel will take control of Rafah even if it leads to a potential breach with the United States. These comments, like many more comments that we've heard over the last couple of months, are in complete contradiction with U.S. stance. And you're going to Israel tomorrow. I feel like I've asked you this question many times, but I'll try again. How will you convince an ally that knows there won't be any serious consequences, even if it ignores U.S. warnings repeatedly?
Thank you, Merrill. Let me, again, thank you also for getting in all of your colleagues' questions, too. First of all, on Doha, I can't speak to CIA director's schedule. I can speak to the fact that he's been doing an extraordinary job in working with our counterparts from Qatar, from Egypt, as well as from Israel, in trying to get to an agreement on a ceasefire with the release of hostages. The teams are working every single day on this. As I said, there's still real challenges. We've closed the gaps, but there are still gaps. So I can't put a timeline on it. I can just say that we're committed to doing everything possible to reaching an agreement, and that work is ongoing as we speak. And I also had an opportunity during this trip, meeting with counterparts from Egypt and from Qatar to help pursue that effort. With regard to Saudi Arabia, what I can tell you is this. This is something, the normalization plan that we've been working on for many months. In fact, we were working on this intensely before October 7th. And in fact, I was scheduled to come to the region, to Saudi Arabia and to Israel, on October 10th, precisely for that reason, and to actually focus on the Palestinian component of the normalization plan. But in terms of where we are now, what I can say is this. We've made very good progress, especially over the last month or so. We still have some work to do, but I believe that, again, the progress is good, it's real. I can't put a time frame on it, but we are, I think, getting close to a point where we'll have agreements. On Rafah, again, we've been very clear, President Biden's been very clear that a major ground operation in Rafah would be a mistake and something that we can't support. There is no place for the many civilians who are massed in Gaza, in Rafah, to go to get out of harm's way. And for those that would inevitably remain, it would be a humanitarian disaster. But there's also a false choice involved here, because we are determined, as Israel is, and indeed as other partners in the region are, to deal with the ongoing problem posed by Hamas, a threat to so many. And Hamas can be effectively dealt with without a major ground operation in Rafah. And one of the reasons that we have counterparts from the Israeli government coming to Washington next week is precisely to focus on that, to share with them our views on what alternative actions could be that would deal with the with this very significant problem, but in a way that does not do further harm to civilians.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken at a news conference in Cairo, Egypt. Secretary plans to be in Israel on Friday. U.S. House Speaker Mike Johnson telling CNBC this morning he plans to invite Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to address a joint meeting of Congress, saying we will certainly extend that invitation. What Chuck Schumer did was just almost staggering, just unbelievable. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer last week called the prime minister in Israel an obstacle to peace and also called for new elections in that country. Senator Schumer saying today on the Senate floor, Israel has no stronger ally than the U.S. and our relationship transcends any one president or any one prime minister. The U.S. Army brass band Pershing's Own Quintet playing in the U.S. Capitol Visitor Center, where American military units from World War II, known as the Ghost Army, received the Congressional Gold Medal. An AP article describes it this way: with inflatable tanks, trucks, and planes, combined with sound effects, radio trickery, costume uniforms, and acting, the American military units that became known as the Ghost Army helped outwit the enemy. Congresswoman Ann Custer, Democrat from New Hampshire, co-sponsored the bill.
During World War II, as the Nazis marched through Europe, this extraordinary top-secret group was given an assignment: deceive the Germans and create an opportunity for the Allied forces to turn the tide of the war. This required innovation, creativity, artistic talent, and a very special kind of courage. Using inflatable tanks and sonic deception, they used sound of thousands of troops, trucks and tanks and jeeps, when there were only dozens of troops. And it worked. They deceived the Germans. The Ghost Army made it appear as though Americans had thousands of troops gathered on the Moselle River and in other parts of the theater. These secret soldiers were innovators, and they played a decisive role in turning the tide and winning the war. And thanks to their ingenuity and boldness, the Ghost Army, as you have heard and will hear over and over, saved tens of thousands of lives.
Congresswoman Ann Custer, Democrat from New Hampshire, at today's ceremony in the U.S. Capitol Visitors Center in Washington. Three of the seven known surviving Ghost Army members attending the ceremony, Seymour Nussenbaum and Bernard Bluestein, both 100 years old, and John Christman, 99 years old. Nussenbaum telling Associated Press, "It was like putting on a big production. We have had, in some cases, people impersonating generals, putting on a general's uniform and walking around the street." Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Subscribe to C-SPAN's free evening newsletter, Word for Word, and you'll get the stories making headlines in Washington sent to your inbox every day. Sign up at cspan.org/connect. Have a good night.